Good morning. Thank you so much for waking up with us and joining us today. Welcome to Recent Advances in Cancer Care, New Paradigms, Novel Agents, and What It Means for the Oncology Nurse, Immunotherapeutic Approaches for Endometrial Cancer. I'm Dr. Dana Chase, and I'll be moderating the meeting this morning. So this is our faculty for today. We have Sarah Karpin. We have Dr. Alejandro Rao-Hein. We have Jacqueline Shaver and myself. Here are the relevant faculty conflicts of interest. And here is the commercial support for today. Research to practice CME Planning Committee staff and reviewers have no conflicts of interest to disclose. This program will contain discussion of non-approved uses of agents and regimens. Please refer to official prescribing information for each product for approved indications. The educational themes focus on the integration of new agents, regimens, and therapies into oncology practice, when they should be used, for whom, and why, as well as how to prevent and manage associated side effects. So this is the program for today, and this is where we're headed for today. We'll start out discussing the biology of endometrial cancer. Then we'll talk about first-line treatment options for advanced or recurrent endometrial cancer, followed by the role of lenvatinib and pembrolizumab, and finish out with other nursing considerations in the care of these patients. So I'm now going to turn it over to Dr. Rao-Hein for the first presentation.
Good morning, everyone, and thanks for being here so early. I think this is the first time that I speak about endometrial cancer at 6 in the morning, so really appreciate you being with us. So if you've been following the endometrial cancer field, you probably heard that in the past we used to talk about two types of endometrial cancer: type 1, usually low-grade endometrial cancers with very good prognosis, and type 2 endometrial cancers used to be the high-grade that had bad prognosis. But everything changed in 2013 when TCGA was published, and we found that there were actually four groups of endometrial cancers, and they were divided in these four groups: poly-E, MSI hypermutated, copy number low, and copy number high. And what we found is that each of these distinct molecular groups have different frequencies, how often they happen, but also different molecular profiles within itself, and also different prognosis for the patients. So as you can see here, patients that have a poly mutation tend to have a much better prognosis compared to those patients that have copy number high. So this molecular staging really, for the first time, allows in a much deeper level understand the prognosis of patients, and perhaps we thought this could be utilized in clinical practice, and in fact, in many parts of the world, this is now a reality in which we now classify patients, in addition to the regular staging, into also a molecular staging. And in fact, the most recent FIGO staging incorporates these different molecular profiles. And maybe in some of your practices, some of the physicians and clinicians are already incorporating these different tests in order to classify patients into these different categories. And in addition to having these prognostic factors, so we can tell what patients do better, so we know that patients that have a poly-E mutation tend to do much better than those patients that are copy number high, these different profiles can help us dictate the different management. So this is data from the PORTEC program, in which they took patients that were included in the study and randomized in the study that received adjuvant chemotherapy, and they tried to find out if these different molecular profiles can help us see how patients did while they received chemotherapy. And as you can see in the figure, patients that have the poly mutations, those patients that have tend to have the best prognosis, it really didn't matter whether they received chemotherapy or didn't receive chemotherapy. They did fine either way. But when you look at patients that have this P53 or copy number high, those patients, there was definitely a difference whether they received chemotherapy or not. And then you have the other two groups in MMR deficient and copy number low, that perhaps there was a difference in chemotherapy. So again, for the first time, we were able to really dissect patients into these different groups to really try to tailor therapies in a much deeper way that we were able to do that before. And in terms of escalating treatment, so enhancing treatment, providing chemotherapy to patients that perhaps were not getting chemotherapy before, but also de-escalating treatment. So if you have a patient with poly mutation, perhaps in the future, those are the patients in which we may not have to do aggressive therapies. In addition to all of this, we now realize that those patients that have an MMR deficient tumors or high tumor burden, those patients tend to respond so well to immunotherapy that all of now it's really incorporated in the management in endometrial cancer, as I'm going to discuss in the next couple of slides. So just want to really highlight how transformational this molecular staging has been for endometrial cancer. And it's very likely that if you take care of patients with endometrial cancer, you're going to start seeing this in your clinics, if you're not already seeing it in your clinics. So just as a quick background, as a backbone for endometrial cancer, for the management, for many, many years, the management included carboplatin paclitaxel. This is the trial GOG-209, that really, a landmark trial that demonstrated that carboplatin paclitaxel was not inferior to the traditional three-drug regimen of TAP. And again, for more than 15, 20 years, this is what we use. Carboplatin paclitaxel for management of endometrial cancer. These are the outcomes that we saw in GOG-209. The patients had a median PFS of around 14 months, and the median overall survival was around 40 months. And this, there was really no movement in endometrial cancer until until we had immunotherapy. And to really understand immunotherapy for endometrial cancer, we need to understand mismatch repair deficiency. So the mismatch repair deficient system, what it does is really tries to find out if there's any alterations in the DNA and tries to fix it. So when there's an issue with this mismatch repair operation, patients tend to have a lot of mutations in the DNA, multiple mutations, and that leads to what we call microsatellite instability. And what happens when you have all of these mutations because the system is not working so well, this creates abnormal proteins that we call neoantigens. And these neoantigens are recognized by the immune system, and therefore, immunotherapy tends to work better in those situations. So this is just a picture showing this. So again, patients that have alterations in this mismatch repair system have these mutations that create these abnormal proteins, neoantigens that are easily recognized by the immune system, and therefore, they're much more sensitive to immune-related therapies. And as a proof of concept, these are the original trials that show that among patients that have mismatch repair deficiency in endometrial cancer, they have profound responses to immunotherapy. And as we're going to see in the next couple of presentations, this has changed completely how we manage patients with endometrial cancer. We've seen these amazing responses among those patients that have mismatch repair deficiency. And in fact, right now we combine with chemotherapy, and perhaps in the future, we might completely get rid of chemotherapy and we might just use immunotherapy in those situations. So I think we have a couple of questions.
Yes, so thank you so much for outlining how biomarkers are essential now in endometrial cancer care. Alejandro, what is the optimal approach to biomarker assessment for patients with newly diagnosed advanced endometrial cancer? Maybe you can tell us how, when you see a new patient, for example, how you incorporate biomarker testing in that new advanced endometrial cancer patient.
Yeah, all of this is evolving. And for example, in Europe, they have already adopted doing this molecular staging. Here in the United States, I think we still, I don't think it's widely adopted. For sure, we always want to do mismatch repair testing. So that's just doing an IHC. So it's very easy to do. In many institutions, that is done by the pathology department automatically. So at least I would say you have to do an assessment of mismatch repair deficiency. And in many institutions, they're already incorporated doing P53 mutation, also done many times by IHC, in other institutions by next-gen sequencing. And then poly-E, I would say, probably is the hardest to incorporate in practices because you have to do next-gen sequencing. So that means that you have to change your whole workflow now to incorporate next-gen sequencing in newly diagnosed patients. I think there are some tests now that might be easier to do poly, but at least mismatch repair deficiency and perhaps P53.
Great. I'm curious, Sarah and Jacqueline, at your institutions, are you having to order these biomarkers, or are they coming automatically on your pathology report?
It's reflex for us, so we work very closely with our pathology team. It's very integrated, so this is not something we're typically requesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's really nice when you see the patient in the office and you already have that on their pathology form and you don't have to request it. But at some institutions, perhaps it's not on the pathology form. You have to take that extra step and ask the lab to run the test. At your institution, is it?
Same thing, yeah. It's automatic. Our pathologists run this on each specimen that they have. With our institution, Poly is one that we have to send out. But other than that, it's all given to us.
Yep. Okay, yeah. And what I'm also curious, at your institutions, Alejandro mentioned some biomarkers that are impactful, Poly, P53, MMR status. Any other biomarkers that at your institutions you're taking into consideration in these advanced patients?
Our advanced patients typically are going to be fully screened, so we are doing full genetic profiles for all of them, which gives us quite a lot of information that's then targetable. But even from our first biopsies, we're getting MMR status, we're getting ERPR, we're getting HER2, so that we can have a mini view of what the patient looks like prior to even surgery sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. In breast cancer and lung cancer, you guys, people have been doing biomarker testing for years now, and it's been incorporated in the patient one-liner. You know, you always include the HER2 status, the ERPR status for the breast cancer patient. And finally, endometrial cancer is catching up, and in our one-liners for our patients, so if you're taking care of an endometrial cancer patient, you should always hear about their MMR status, at least, in their one-liner as you're doing sign-out or discussing patients amongst each other. Yeah.
And I think from a nursing perspective, you know, always be on the lookout for these things and help the provider say, hey, do you remember, did they do this on the pathology report? So just something from a nursing perspective that you can kind of look through when you're prepping your clinics to ensure that those things were done. Because sometimes things get missed. And so that's one thing that you can do to kind of help your patients is to ensure that this testing was done.
Yeah, I think that's a good point also. The patients, some patients, many of them actually these days, want to know their biomarker status, and they kind of ask about it. And so I think I see in our institution, sometimes the nurses really have a great deal of responsibility in terms of making sure the patient's educated about their tumor and their tumor characteristics.
And just one more thing about MMR status that I think is so important to mention is that keep in mind that some of these patients with alterations on IHC might actually have Lynch syndrome. So just keep in mind that, you know, at least raising the concern, and many of these patients end up going to genetic counseling because if they have Lynch syndrome, they have obviously implications for the patients, risk of colon cancer, GU cancers, but also for their family members. So nowadays we do cascade genetic testing. So, you know, keep in mind that if you have a patient that is MMR deficient, perhaps there's underlying Lynch syndrome as well.
Yeah, very good point. I mean, the majority of patients that are MMR deficient do not have Lynch syndrome, but it's a screening test for Lynch syndrome. So, and Lynch syndrome is a hereditary cancer syndrome. Women with Lynch syndrome are at risk for endometrial cancer and colon cancer and other cancers as well. All right, so now we're going to move on to first-line therapy for advanced or recurrent endometrial cancer. All right. So these are our objectives. So currently, we have some treatment options for patients with metastatic or recurrent endometrial cancer. And these are all three FDA approved based on these three trials, the RUBY trial, GY018, and DUO-E. DUO-E also included pMMR patients or patients that did not have a deficiency in MMR, but the FDA indication is just for the dMMR patients. And the RUBY trial is dostarlimab, GY018 is pembrolizumab, and DUO-E is durvalumab. And so those are the three immunotherapy agents that are combined with our best friends, carboplatin and paclitaxel. And of course, the immunotherapy is given in maintenance. So you'll see the patient for their 4 to 6 hour infusion, carboplatin, paclitaxel, immunotherapy, and then they'll get their immunotherapy maintenance after the 6 cycles. So the RUBY trial was FDA approved in 2023, and we recently saw some updated data on the RUBY trial. You can see the survival curve is on the right. So time is on the x-axis, and the percent of patients that are still alive on the bottom or alive without a recurrence on the top, you can see. And you can see the two different lines. The top line is the patients that got immunotherapy, and the bottom line are the patients that only got carboplatin paclitaxel. And so you can see that top line, there's more patients that are alive without recurrence or alive without having died on the immunotherapy arm compared to the placebo arm. And so this was really impactful because you can see how those curves flatten out there. This is the pMMR patients, so we still see a signal that the pMMR patients also benefit from the immunotherapy, and so there was expanded FDA approval in 2026. GY018 is now the trial that incorporated pembrolizumab, and in this trial, you see both benefits in the pMMR and in the dMMR patient. Again, that top line is the immunotherapy arm of the study. And then in the pMMR patients, although the signal is not as strong, we do still see overall survival potentially being impacted by the immunotherapy in GY018 as well. And so in GY018, we also have FDA approval for both the dMMR and the pMMR patients. Now, the DUO-E trial, a little more complicated. We're going to hear about that in the next presentation or so. This is durvalumab. Based on this trial, we got approval only in the dMMR patient population. This trial also included treatment with a PARP inhibitor, which I'm not going to go into right now. But as you can see, that very top line are the patients treated with immunotherapy, and the bottom line are the patients treated with placebo. And we basically saw a difference between the durvalumab and the placebo arms, leading to FDA approval for the dMMR patient. So this, we're going to have some time now to talk about the patient case. So this is a patient of mine. This is a 64-year-old. She had a traditional laparoscopic hysterectomy with sentinel lymph node dissection in September 2024 in an outside hospital. She was an early stage patient. She was a candidate for brachytherapy, so she got radiation after her hysterectomy, and she completed radiation in December 2024. In January of this year, she presents with some abdominal discomfort. She's in my office. She says she has an appointment for a colonoscopy. She has kind of very vague, sort of mild left upper quadrant discomfort, worsens with position changes, subsides with passing gas and walking. So I'm thinking maybe this is GI, occasional rectal bleeding. She had already made the appointment with the gastroenterologist, was already kind of in that sort of workup. Medical history, this patient is an active 64-year-old. She used to be a case manager. She now has a baking business. She's a former smoker. She has 3 children that live nearby, so she's got a good support system. And she's really still actively working, still wants to keep active and work. Interestingly, her mother had breast cancer in her 50s. And I'll just point out, she has MLH1 and PMS2 loss, so that means she's dMMR. That means when those proteins are lost, that means they're mutated. That means that they're not staining like a normal protein would stain. So when it says MLH1, PMS2 loss, that means dMMR. So if you see that on a patient case in your institution, that means dMMR. What I mean by MLH1 promoter methylation is that this is the protein itself is not mutated, but the promoter of the protein is affected, and that's why the protein's not being read. So this patient does not have hereditary cancer syndrome. She doesn't have Lynch syndrome. She has a somatic a loss of the protein. On physical exam, this patient's BMI is 34. No findings on physical exam for me to suspect that there was a tumor in her abdomen. This is actually her CT scan, and you can see that arrow on the your right, pointing to a tumor near the diaphragm, kind of on top of the liver there. And that tumor is her cancer coming back, unfortunately. She also had moderate volume ascites, and there were several other new enhancing peritoneal nodules in her abdomen, compatible with peritoneal carcinomatosis. So unfortunately, this DMMR patient is having a recurrence. She started on carboplatin, paclitaxel, dostarlimab, and then goes on dostarlimab maintenance. So again, you give the immunotherapy, the dostarlimab, you give it with the carboplatin paclitaxel for 6 cycles, and then the patient goes on dostarlimab maintenance. Around cycle 2 of her chemotherapy, she had a rash on her lower extremity. It was kind of a very mild, a little bit itchy rash. Sometimes I will say with these patients on immunotherapy, the rash can be kind of subtle, and sometimes I'm not sure if it's immunotherapy related or not, but for her, tried topical Benadryl and hydrocortisone without relief, and ultimately did a steroid taper dose pack, and it resolved. So here's a patient that got treated with the Ruby regimen. What's nice about this regimen is, like I said, you go on a maintenance, and when the patient goes on dostarlimab maintenance, they're not coming in for their 4 to 6 hour infusion. It's relatively short, and that can also be extended to every 6 weeks instead of every 3 weeks, which is nice for a patient, especially one that wants to continue to work, that wants to continue to be active. Okay, so we're going to get into some discussion questions. So Alejandro, maybe you can tell me, at your institution, how do you choose between dostarlimab, pembrolizumab, or durvalumab in combination with first-line chemotherapy for patients with MSI-high or DMMR endometrial cancer?
So I think what it's very clear is that all of these three agents, in terms of clinical efficacy and side effect profile, are really the same. You know, there might be slightly differences in the side effects, perhaps, but really the clinical efficacy of these three agents, you know, we can all agree that it's pretty much the same. So for me personally, I've been using pembrolizumab for a long time. I use it in other cancer sites like cervix cancer, so I feel more comfortable using pembrolizumab, so that's why I use it. The other thing about pembrolizumab is you have to give it for 2 years only. Dostarlimab, technically, according to the Ruby trial, you have to give it for 3 years. So that's how I make the decision. But at the end, really, whatever you have access to it, it's okay. All of these agents work so well in patients that are MMR deficient that it really, I don't think it really matters.
And what about your PMMR patients? So as you saw in the presentation, The response in the PMMR patient is not as wide. So those curves of the two different groups of patients kind of narrows, right? The difference is not as great in terms of their outcomes. So what is your approach with the PMMR patient?
So, this is where there's a lot of controversy in our field. There are some oncologists that believe that because there's nothing else that we can offer patients, they give it to all patients with endometrial cancer, regardless for MMR status. At our institution, we kind of decided that the data is so compelling for MMR deficient that for sure we always offer for patients that are MMR deficient. And then for patients that are MMR proficient, we have more of a conversation with the patients and are a little more selective. So we don't give it to everyone. We just do it case by case.
Yeah, so what I'm hearing is that knowing the DMMR or the PMMR status of the patient is going to help you counsel the patient about the efficacy and the response that they should expect. And potentially with the PMMR patients, we are a little more picky in terms of what we choose to use. So what about at your institution, Jacqueline? Do you have preference in terms of one of the agents?
We usually use Pembro. That's what we usually go to. Like you said, we're just more comfortable with that agent. And so most generally we use pembrolizumab. Our providers are comfortable with it. Our nursing staff is comfortable with it. And so, but like he said, most generally each individual immunotherapy has basically the same profile and also kind of depends on insurance as well. And so some insurance companies will want to do one immunotherapy over another. And so we have to take a look at that as well.
Yeah, and I didn't point it out in my talk, but there were some eligibility criteria that were different amongst the three trials. So, for example, on the RUBY trial, it included patients with uterine carcinosarcoma. So carcinosarcoma is a particularly aggressive endometrial cancer, one of the most aggressive types, and those patients were included on the RUBY trial, and that is called out in our NCCN guidelines. So, Sarah, any thoughts for you at your institution in terms of how you think these regimens are equivalent or not in terms of efficacy or perhaps tolerability?
I do want to reflect one of the main things that does help guide this decision is comfort and provider comfort. And so for some of our providers who have been there for now decades, using pembrolizumab is a little bit more comfortable, but we do have some newer providers who are coming out of fellowship recently, and we're starting to see some change in practice. But of course, that change in practice is always guided by our insurance coverage. So I think that's a really good point to bring up. And for the nursing support teams in here, for some of our for our nurses who are talking to patients about insurance coverage, because sometimes this is a big problem, we have to explain to patients that just because one might be used versus the other, it doesn't necessarily mean that the efficacy is going to be changed or this is going to change their treatment course. And actually, a lot of these treatment courses are exactly the same. So I do think that it's important for the patients to understand that their provider might say, we want to start X medication, but there could be a reason why Y is used, and it doesn't mean their treatment course is going to be altered.
Great. Well, that
leads
us now to your talk.
So, yes, exactly.
So let's get into it.
Okay. Wonderful. So we're going to be talking about tolerability and other practical considerations when using some of these agents in advanced endometrial cancer. So again, what are the AEs? What are the immune-related AEs? And how do we monitor for these? And how do we manage them in regards to our monitoring programs? How do we figure out, are these toxicities related to the immunotherapy or are they related to our chemotherapy? And then what are some absolute and relative contraindications to starting these therapies in patients, some with pre-existing autoimmune conditions, given that we're using an immunotherapy, and of course, solid organ transplant. So the majority of our patients who are on these immunotherapies have very mild to moderate side effects when we actually are looking at them. About 50, 40 to 45% of these are having side effects, but many of these patients, less than 1%, actually are not having, they're not actually having fatal events. These are mild symptoms. The most common side effects that we're seeing are our itises. So that's going to be our rash or pruritus. That's going to be diarrhea, colitis. Commonly we're seeing hypothyroidism, less commonly hyperthyroidism, and some pneumonitis. But of course, what we really want to counsel patients with is our high-risk AEs. So that's going to be our hepatitis, which is about 50% of our high-grade cases, colitis, about 40% of our high-grade cases, a grade 3 or above, pneumonitis, which is the most common cause of IR-related death, myocarditis, myasthenia gravis is rare, but potentially fatal, and same thing with our skin toxicities. Breaking it down by organ system, you can again see that hypothyroidism is more common than hyperthyroidism. Diarrhea and colitis in our GI profile are some of our most common GI side effects, in addition to AST and ALT elevation with our hepatitis. Pneumonitis, a little bit less common, but again can be severe. So one of the most important things we counsel patients on is timing, because a lot of patients in our chemotherapy arms will say that they have side effects after the first cycle. But these are a little bit different because our side effects lag. And so we have a patient who starts on a medication and they might not notice a side effect until multiple weeks or months after starting therapy. So our first side effect that we're typically seeing is our dermatologic side effects, like that rash we were talking about earlier. After that, we can see more of those GI side effects and our transaminitis, but the GI side effects typically that I'm encountering in clinic is going to be diarrhea, which we'll get into in a little bit. The pulmonary and endocrine side effects start usually a couple months into treatment, but again, it's important to recognize that these medications can have latent side effect profiles. Even when stopping these medications, patients can still get side effects. And that's actually one of the very important counseling things, that we have conversations with these patients before starting medication so they are aware and their family members are aware. So what we're doing for all of our patients, obviously, is a physical exam prior to starting. Understanding the patient and any family history of autoimmune disease, as well as any infectious profile like HIV or hepatitis. We're doing routine blood work, checking their thyroid status, and if we have a suspicion that they have a high risk for cardiac disease, we're doing baseline EKGs and troponins. Pulmonary function tests are really only done preemptively on patients who have a high risk for lung toxicity, like previous COPD. And then as we continue monitoring through therapy, our practice is to do routine labs prior to each cycle, including that TSH and free T4. We do a serum cortisol check, and then, of course, for our high-risk patients, doing troponins. But most of our patients who are starting on therapy, if they do have a high risk for cardiac disease, we're using cardiology as a resource to have them being, to have them followed. So that's another thing to consider when talking to these patients, that they might have more regular cardiology evaluation. Obviously, we're checking vitals, including their oxygen status. But it's an important thing to notice here that our hypothyroid and hyperthyroid, that one of our most common AEs most of the time, is asymptomatic, which is why we're checking these labs and counseling our patients that this can happen. So our management is based off of our grading. NCCN has an excellent resource for grading. It's algorithmic, so for grade one, we're monitoring these patients, not necessarily stopping therapy, supporting them with symptomatic and supportive care. Of course, if the patient has evidence of myocarditis or some more severe neurologic toxicity, we can consider stopping these medications. If we have a grade two event, we can continue to treat the patient but hold the medication until those side effects resolve back to lower than grade one. Our hallmark here is going to be prednisone, and if we do have a grade three, we're going to be switching to our IV methylpred instead of prednisone. Of course, at that point, we're going to consider maybe we can't use this medication in these patients anymore, and then obviously obtaining consultation with whatever specialist and organ system that we're dealing with. At grade four, we're no longer using those medications. By that point, typically these patients are pretty sick. Most of the time they're in the hospital, with the exception of some of our higher grade thyroid issues, which we can use repletion for these patients. For patients who are on tapers, we're doing a long taper. This is an example how we would be using this management guideline for diarrhea, pretty similar to what I just went over. And our hallmark, again, is steroids. So for our patients who are on immunotherapy versus chemotherapy, we can usually distinguish if it's an immunotherapy response, because hypothyroid, pneumonitis, myocarditis, arthritis, any itis is going to be that immunotherapy component, versus our chemotherapy or PARP component, which is going to be our penias, neutropenia, thrombocytopenia, and myelosuppression with anemia. Hair loss, neuropathy, cycle-dependent nausea and vomiting, it's going to be really more of our chemo. We do have some overlapping factors like rash and fatigue, but if you want to try to de-challenge these patients by holding the non-immunotherapy agent first, those symptoms will resolve, then you know it was probably not that immunotherapy. And if you want to continue moving forward, and you actually have persistent AEs, you can treat with steroids, and that's typically a diagnostic clue. So our patients who've had any severe hypersensitivity to these drugs, it is contraindicated. We have higher risk for anyone who's on immunosuppression, and that's uncontrolled, or any patient who has an autoimmune disease that's uncontrolled. Solid organ transplant patients are higher risk, and any other severe autoimmune or infectious disease. And we always consider having these patients counseled by their specialist.
Thank you so much for running through potential AEs. I will reiterate that while severe AEs on immunotherapies are not super common, if we miss them, it can be devastating to the patient, especially a patient who's having a response to immunotherapy. And then, for example, if we miss a colitis, the patient gets admitted to the hospital. It takes weeks for that colitis to improve, and potentially that very effective therapy cannot be given to the patient. So nurses in the infusion center, for example, in my experience in my practice, play a critical role in picking up on some of these toxicities. You know, a patient will say she has diarrhea, but you really need to know how many times a day is that diarrhea, and then really important to hold the therapy if there's any question that that diarrhea can be related. Okay. So let's get into potential benefits of PARP inhibition combined with immunotherapy in advanced endometrial cancer.
Great. So I think, as we talked before, there are four large randomized trials that really have shown that immunotherapy works in endometrial cancer. And this is a busy slide, but I think what I want to highlight is that, as we have talked at length before, these immunotherapies really work for patients that are MMR deficient. And you can see here, like in the median progression-free survival, and the hazard ratio in those groups is really substantial. It's like this is transformational for patients that are MMR deficient. That is not the case for patients that are MMR proficient. These benefits are marginal. And in some of the trials, actually, there was very little benefit. So the question is, for these patients that are MMR proficient, that, by the way, is like two-thirds of the patients with endometrial cancer, is there anything else that we can do to prime them so the immunotherapy works better? So that is the question that we're trying to answer by adding PARP inhibitors. And there are two trials that try to answer this question, that if you add a PARP inhibitor in addition to the immunotherapy, whether we can, in particular in patients that are MMR proficient, whether we can enhance the immunotherapy for those patients again, particularly those that are MMR proficient. So PARP inhibitors, very frequently used in ovarian cancer and now in other cancers like pancreatic cancer, breast cancer. But the way PARP inhibitors work is that we know that PARP is an enzyme that is really important to try to prevent DNA single-strand breaks. So when there is no PARP, when this enzyme doesn't work very well, you have these single DNA breaks that eventually become like double DNA breaks, and eventually the cell dies. So if you can inhibit PARP, you can cause these breaks in the DNA and potentially cause cell death. And when we see in ovarian cancer, for example, is that in patients that have a BRCA mutation, the whole system of DNA repair is not working, then you add an extra layer by inhibiting PARP, and then therefore the patients can have excellent prognosis. So what happens in endometrial cancer, what we're trying to do is, if we give a PARP inhibitor, what we're trying to cause is these breaks in DNA. So by breaking the DNA, we are creating like DNA that floats in the cell, and then eventually the cell dies, and that creates new antigens of these abnormal proteins that we talked about before, or the DNA itself is abnormal, and the immune system can recognize that. So the hope is that, again, is that if you give a PARP inhibitor, you're causing cell death, causing neoantigens, and perhaps the immunotherapy can work better. So that is the rationale behind using PARP inhibitors in addition to immunotherapy in a very simplistic way. So this is the first study of the DUO-E, and Dr. Chase talked a little bit about this study. And so it's a three-arm study. Included patients with advanced stage recurrent endometrial cancer, included patients who were MMR proficient and MMR deficient, and patients were randomized to either carboplatin paclitaxel, the standard, carboplatin paclitaxel and immunotherapy, in this case durvalumab, or carboplatin paclitaxel durvalumab, the immunotherapy, plus a PARP inhibitor, in this case, olaparib. And what it's important is that when we look at the outcomes from DUI, it is very clear that it works for patients with endometrial cancer. And it met the endpoint, you know, all the endpoints, and it's now approved. But I think what it's more important is what happens in those patients that are MMR proficient. So this is a Kaplan-Meier curve in patients that are MMR deficient. As you can see, in MMR deficient, the patients that receive Durva, Durvalumab, and Olaparib, or Durvalumab alone, have profound improvements in progression-free survival. The curves really separate, so these are very profound differences in terms of progression-free survival. But this is what happens in those patients that are MMR proficient. It looks like in patients, if you give Durvalumab and Olaparib, perhaps there's even an extra benefit in that group. And you can see it, I think the easiest way to see it is you look at the hazard ratio in the table. The hazard ratio for the, in the, if you compare that to the control group, was 0.57, opening the door that perhaps this group of patients in which immunotherapy doesn't work, if you add PARP inhibitors, perhaps you can get that extra benefit. And if you have treated patients with ovarian cancer, we know that PARP inhibitors work very well, in particular patients that in which the DNA repair damage mechanism works, so patients with BRCA mutations. So in this study, they tried to look at whether if there's abnormality in this, in those mechanisms, perhaps those are the patients that are going to benefit the most. So this is a post hoc exploratory analysis, so suggesting that perhaps in this group of patients that have BRCA or BRCA-like mutations, these combinations can work a little bit better. And this is the second study. This is Ruby Part 2. So we talked about Ruby Part 1. It's the study of looking at dostarlimab. So in Ruby Part 2, again, very similar to Ruby Part 1, patients with advanced stage or recurrent endometrial cancer were randomized to either dostarlimab, and in this case, niraparib, versus just, you know, versus just chemotherapy alone. And what we found in Ruby Part 2 is that, again, overall, the study met their primary endpoint in terms of progression-free survival, but when they looked at the patients that were MMR proficient, this addition of a PARP inhibitor to immunotherapy seemed to have that extra benefit with a hazard ratio of 0.63 and a p-value that was 0.006, suggesting that, again, there's some benefit by adding a PARP inhibitor to immunotherapy. What I would say is that even these results, you know, we have these results, they are definitely thought-provoking. Currently, the combination of a PARP inhibitor and immunotherapy, it's technically not approved by the FDA in the United States. So this is not widely adopted. I think this in the future might be used perhaps for a selected group of patients based on biomarkers, but as of now, we routinely don't use these combinations in clinical practice. And this, again, this is just a table looking at if there's any molecular profiles in which these combinations can work better, and similar to what we saw in the DUI, in patients that have these alterations in the DNA damage response mechanism, perhaps the combinations work a little bit better.
Okay, thank you so much. Yes, currently using a PARP inhibitor with immunotherapy in endometrial cancer, it remains a little bit controversial. I'm curious, at your institution, are you, I know you guys participated in mm-hmm. those trials, are you using PARP inhibitors with immunotherapy?
We participate in DOE. We do not use PARP inhibitors with immunotherapy. And it's interesting because, again, the unmet need is those patients are MMR proficient, and it's like 70% of the patients. So right now, we talked before, some institutions, they give immunotherapy to those patients. So, you know, whether we can dissect and really understand what patients benefit the most by these combinations, I think it's going to be critical in the future. But as of now, we don't use this combination.
And I think what's also interesting is in our ovarian cancer patients, we know that HRD or that a BRCA mutation is a biomarker for response, but not necessarily in endometrial cancer, right?
Correct. And I think there's this post-hoc analysis that I mentioned, but I would say I think there's all preliminary and thought-provoking, but definitely not, you know, being able to apply in routine clinical practice.
Yeah, so Jacqueline, what about at your institution? Are you seeing PARP inhibitor with immunotherapy usage?
We are not currently doing that as well. So kind of the same thing. It's we're still kind of dissecting all the data, and then we'll proceed from there.
Yep. Any concerns, for example? Well, perhaps I should ask you, since you talked about toxicity, any concerns about the toxicity with PARP and immunotherapy?
Of course, when we add any combination therapy, we're going to have to dissect those toxicities. But I think that with the short half-life of a PARP inhibitor, it's a little bit easier to discern whether that's going to be an immunotherapy versus PARP inhibitor. Our immunotherapy half-life is quite longer, so, and also the standard treatment course is going to be different. So we have our hallmark being steroids for our immunotherapy, with PARP being a little bit different. So it's a little bit more similar to chemotherapy, so less worrisome, in my opinion, to deal with.
Okay. Yep. You know, PARP inhibitors, I'm sure many of you have. How many of you have experience with patients on PARP inhibitors? Yes, I'm sure you know they come with their unique side effect profile. So then adding on immunotherapy and that also having a unique side effect profile potentially is more to manage with these patients. I will say for me, at our institution, not really using PARP inhibitors with immunotherapy as of yet. The PMMR patient population, like we've tried to emphasize, does not gain as much of a benefit in terms of survival and recurrence as the DMMR patient. So in that patient population that's particularly high risk for recurrence, you want to be a little more aggressive, perhaps, to try to get that immunotherapy to work better. And so the question is the PARP inhibitor the answer to that? If you add the PARP inhibitor to the immunotherapy, are you going to see more of a benefit? But on the DUO-E trial, we didn't have an arm on that trial where patients were getting PARP inhibitors alone. So that kind of complicates the question. All right, so we're going to jump into now side effects and other practical considerations with PARP inhibitors, and Jacqueline's going to take us through this talk.
Okay, so with combining PARP inhibitors and immunotherapy frequently results in manageable, safety profile, but increased toxicity compared to monotherapy. So some of the common side effects, as you know, with PARP inhibitors are fatigue, nausea, diarrhea, and hematologic toxicities. Some specific combinations we've seen with niraparib and immunotherapy can cause some increased nausea and hypertension. Olaparib causes some immunotherapy, some increased associated diarrhea. And so with that, the immunotherapy can cause colitis. And so, is it going to be the olaparib causing the diarrhea versus the immunotherapy? And so that's something we have to try to tease out and determine, do we need to do steroids at that point or continue to monitor? And that will all be in relation to the degree of toxicity with that. And then the rucaparib, you can have some increased liver enzymes, fatigue, and GI side effects. So some key side effect profile is with the hematologic toxicity. Anemia is the most common, so 50 to 41% incidence of over grade 3. So we're going to need to be, transfusing these patients with blood. So if the patient calls and say, I'm just really fatigued, I'm really tired, I'm having short of breath, we may need to bring them into the clinic, get a CBC to see, do these patients need blood transfusion. Thrombocytopenia, if the patients call and they say, hey, I'm having all this bruising, or when I brush my teeth, I'm having all this bleeding, we have to think, are they thrombocytopenic? So again, bringing those patients in, critical when the patients call during the triage line is to contact the provider, and then we may need to bring them in for evaluation. Neutropenia, their white count is low, assessing for fever, making sure when we start patients on these agents, letting them know these are the parameters we want you to call. If they're having a fever, 100.4 or higher, don't take that Tylenol home. Make sure that you call us and let us know. We may need to bring you in again and to see if we're having a neutropenic fever.
GI effects, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, making sure they have those antiemetics at home and making sure that they're taking those antiemetics with their PARP inhibitor. PARP inhibitor is very notorious for causing nausea. So essentially, you know, you need to make sure that they're taking that prior to the PARP inhibitor so they stay on PARP. You know, this is an oral medication, and so they're at home taking these medications, and if they're feeling nauseous and they know the PARP inhibitor is causing nausea, sometimes patients don't take their PARP inhibitor. And so we need to keep them on these drugs to have the effects that we want from these PARP inhibitors. So it's really important from an education standpoint to make sure that they are taking their antiemetics and they have them and they don't run out of their refills. And so that's important for us to ensure when we see them in the office and we talk to them on the phone, are you taking your antiemetics or do you have enough refill? So that's really important kind of point to talk about there. The fatigue, it's really common in that first 3 months with PARP inhibitors. And so just educating them, you know, hey, you know, when you are on this maintenance, you may still feel like you're on, you know, chemotherapy for the first 3 months. And just letting them know that you it will get better as time progresses. And just encourage them to, you know, of course, you know, let us know if there's something that is affecting their ADLs at home, that they're unable to get up, you know, and get out of bed and having trouble, you know, doing their normal activities, such as putting on their clothes and things like that. So it's really important to kind of let us know about that. And then with the combination, you can have higher incidences of rash, pneumonitis, and colitis. Some key monitorings with PARP inhibitors. They require frequent CBCs and CMP for niraparib. They recommend weekly monitoring for the first month. And then monthly after that, your olaparib or crapirib is monthly monitoring. And then after the first 3 months, if they're stable with their hematologic toxicities, then can space that out to every 3 months. With niraparib, just important education is it can cause elevated blood pressure. So making sure if they are on niraparib, they have a blood pressure monitor at home, that it works. They can bring it into the office and they can make sure the calibration is what it needs to be to ensure that they're not having hypertension at home and educate them as well as they may not feel that they have high blood pressure. And so they need to be able to take those home blood pressure monitors, keep a log, a diary, bring those into the office. And so then we can either start them on medication or adjust as needed. And then based upon their toxicities, we may need to hold or dose reduce as indicated. And then rare but could have a long-term side effect in regards to MDS and AML. So if we're looking for those persistent cytopenias even after they have completed PARP. We've kind of talked about this, but some common side effects with the olaparib, nausea, vomiting, the niraparib. It is dosed based upon weight and platelet count and hepatic impairment. And so before we start on a niraparib, you need to look at their weight and look at their platelets and dose and adjust the dose based upon those two factors. And again, the hypertension is important. And then rucaparib, it can cause some increased liver enzymes, creatinine. I talked about this a little bit before. The first 3 months, your side effects are going to be worse and improve. Oral medication compliance, make sure they're taking their medications, frequency of the lab values and office visits. Again, taking the antiemetics prior to taking PARP, home blood pressure monitoring, and then reporting the symptoms to us as soon as possible. Some things I think is important also just to make sure that you educate patients about is get a pill organizer. So that they don't forget to take their pills. Make sure you have your antiemetics and the PARP inhibitor in the same pill organizer so it just causes them to be able to be compliant with taking the PARP. Set an alarm on their phones. Make a calendar. Put a sticky note on your mirror, on your refrigerator, something like that, in your car, to help the patients remind them to take their oral medications. Ensuring that they have the clinic phone numbers day and night to report those symptoms, and making sure the staff is adequately educated in regards to when the patient does call, what to do, when to call the providers, and given that patient education that they need. again, making sure they have refills on their supportive medication, blood pressure monitor. And also just remember the social needs of these patients as well, making sure they have support in regards to transportation, finances, mental health, nutrition, and then refer when appropriate. So this is a study, a patient of mine. She is a 57-year-old Caucasian female, G2P2 with recurrent stage 3C1 grade 2 endometrial cancer. She has obesity, BMI of 45, and just some seasonal allergies. She was in, when she first presented, we were unsure if it was cervix versus endometrial cancer. She had a lower uterine segment mass, 4.8 centimeters, that was invading into the cervix, and she also had left parametrial involvement. So we got MRI and PET CT scan. And ultimately was treated with neoadjuvant cisplatin, whole pelvic radiation, and brachytherapy. She then underwent a robotic hysterectomy, BSO lymph node dissection in June of 19, followed by additional four cycles of Taxol carbo. She completed that in September of 2019. Unfortunately, she had a recurrence at the spleen. She had a splenic lesion about 2.3 centimeters and was placed on our DUO-E, our clinical trial. So she had Taxol, Carbo, Durvo times six cycles and completed that in December of 21. And at that time, her splenic lesion was about 1.2 centimeters. She completed DUO-E maintenance in December of 2024, and overall she tolerated pretty well with persistent nausea that was controlled with antiemetics. At that time, her CT, her splenic lesion was 1 centimeter, so she had a little bit of improvement with her splenic lesion. We did a PET CT scan. She didn't have any AVID lesions that were there, and we actually did some molecular and residual disease tests that was negative. So we couldn't find any circulating tumor DNA that was positive, and so that was great news for her, and really shows, you know, with the addition of the immunotherapy and maybe the PARP inhibitors that we have a really good response there. So she's currently in surveillance, doing well. NED, her CAT scan on April 17, she had a stable splenic lesion at 0.6. She's 5 years out from her initial recurrence. And so this goes to show you, you know, the immunotherapy has really changed our recurrent endometrial cancer patients. When I first started, when someone was diagnosed with recurrent endometrial cancer, we all know that likely that we weren't going to survive, and now this patient is now 5 years out from her initial recurrence. So I think that's an amazing.
Amazing, yeah. Gosh, I mean, this is like an incredible success story.
Yeah.
I just want to mention, did you mention her biomarkers? Was she HRD or BRCA?
She was not BRCA, and I think she was MRP.
MRP. And I want to mention, those of you in the audience that have heard of BRCA mutation, the BRCA mutation is the mutation that causes hereditary breast and ovarian cancer, and it can be inherited, or you can have it in your tumor and not have inherited it. HRD is the personality of BRCA. It's kind of like if you have an issue with how you repair double-stranded DNA that causes this personality called HRD. Now, you can have HRD and not have BRCA. So you can be BRCA mutated or BRCA not mutated and have HRD. And HRD and BRCA, we typically talk about in ovarian cancer, but in the setting of DUO-E, we also are considering it in endometrial cancer sometimes, although, like we said earlier, the biomarkers didn't pan out the same way, potentially, in the endometrial cancer setting. All right, so now we're going to jump into second-line endometrial cancer. And I'm going to talk about the role of lenvatinib and pembrolizumab in the management of second-line endometrial cancer. These are our objectives, and I'm really hoping that I can get to my case presentation. So currently, treatment of recurrent or second-line endometrial cancer means that the patient has had prior chemotherapy, meaning they got carboplatin paclitaxel with immunotherapy or without immunotherapy. Perhaps they got carboplatin paclitaxel with bevacizumab, or maybe they got carboplatin paclitaxel with trastuzumab, and now they're recurring. And currently, in the second-line setting, we can use immunotherapy. We talked about using immunotherapy in the first round of chemotherapy for the patient. We can now use immunotherapy also in the second line. So potentially for a patient who has had immunotherapy or has not had immunotherapy, we can use immunotherapy in the second line. So one option for these patients is lenvatinib and pembrolizumab. And there was a large phase 3 clinical trial that randomized patients called KEYNOTE-775. Some of the patients, 1-to-1, half of the patients got lenvatinib with pembro, and the other half got physician's choice chemotherapy. So that was either doxorubicin or weekly paclitaxel. And the lenvatinib is an oral medication, and the pembro, as you know, is IV. And the idea of combining the two is lenvatinib targets VEGF. So it's one pathway that the cancer uses to grow, meaning the VEGF pathway is a pathway that allows the cancer to grow its own blood supply. And so lenvatinib attacks that pathway. The pembrolizumab attacks a different pathway. The pembrolizumab essentially allows the immunotherapy, allows the immune system to recognize the tumor as foreign. So the idea is to target two pathways. It's kind of like when you're driving to work. If there's one blockage on one street, you can always take the other street. Well, imagine if both streets are blocked, both streets have accidents or construction, you can't get to work. And so it's kind of blocking two routes to work in order to really target the cancer. So these were the patients that were on the trial. Just want to point out that there were high-risk patients on these trials. There were patients with clear cell and serous cancers, which are some of our highest-risk endometrial cancers. And these are, again, those Kaplan-Meier curves. Again, time is on the x-axis, and progression-free survival is on the y-axis. So at time zero, 100% of patients have no progression. But as you see time go by, you see some patients are starting to progress. But you can see the green line is the LenPem arm, the lenvatinib with pembro, and the black line is the physician's choice chemotherapy. And the difference in progression-free survival was 6.7 months versus 3.8 months. So physician's choice chemotherapy, the patients, the median progression-free survival was 3.8 months. So that's not great, right? Lenvatinib with pembro added some benefit there, 6.7 months. And then what was amazing to see, and I should have mentioned, this is in a pMMR patient population. So this is not the dMMR patients. So overall survival was also impacted in a second-line patient population, and median overall survival, 18 months versus 12 months. And again, that green line is the LenPem, and the black line is the physician's choice chemotherapy. So we were jumping for joy when we saw that second-line patients all of a sudden had a survival benefit from a new regimen. So now I have some time to talk about my patient. So this is when all patients are memorable. But this one was particularly memorable because this patient was a photographer for professional tennis, and she, at 87, wanted to still go to these tennis tournaments to Wimbledon to take photos. So it was really important to her that she had the ability to travel and that she stayed well. So she was originally diagnosed as an early stage patient. Unfortunately, despite being early stage, in 2015, she had blood with cough, and she was put on carboplatin and paclitaxel because of a recurrence to her lung. Eventually, 4 months later, she progressed. Not surprising, some, pMMR patients, which I should have mentioned, she's pMMR. pMMR patients do not respond very well in recurrence to carboplatin and paclitaxel. She had progression in her lung, and in October, she started lenvatinib and pembro. Now, I want to mention, this 87-year-old is one of the tiniest 87-year-olds that I've ever taken care of. She's very active, and she also does not eat a lot just at baseline. And so she was started on that first dose, that 20-milligram dose with pembro, but had dose reductions all the way down to 8 milligrams of lenvatinib with pembro due to fatigue, weight loss, and hypertension. So she has two kids that are very active in her care, and like I said, she was still working, and really that was very important to her. You can see her lung nodule there on her CT scan, and I will say the next generation sequencing is a panel that many of us order in our patients with endometrial cancer. We talked a little bit about this earlier. On her molecular profile, she had no actionable biomarkers. So this is a pMMR patient that didn't really have any options historically for targeted therapy. And so this is the typical patient where lenvatinib and pembro can be offered. And she was on lenvatinib with pembro for 1.5 years. So she not only surpassed the 6-month PFS, but she went over a year on lenvatinib and pembro. And remember, she had many dose reductions. So she was on an 8-milligram dose of lenvatinib, which is a very, very low dose. Ultimately, though, she recurred, and we started her on a hormone therapy, letrozole, which eventually she transitioned to megestrol acetate and tamoxifen. And ultimately, unfortunately, she passed away in September 2024. But the reason why I think this patient is a great case because she really had a long benefit to the LenPem and she could continue to work on it. That being said, despite it being a pill, just like PARP inhibitors, sometimes these pills have more side effects than the patients realize. And so it's really important that these patients that start lenvatinib and pembro have their antihypertensives on board, their nausea medicine on board when they're at home and they're on their own kind of taking their lenvatinib and using their supportive care medications. So this patient, despite being on an oral medication, required a lot of chart messages, a lot of phone calls to keep her eating and to keep her on this therapy. All right, so we're going to get into some discussion questions here. So Alejandro, is lenvatinib and pembro your preferred second-line regimen for most patients with relapsed or refractory pMMR endometrial cancer?
So this is such a good question, and I'll start saying that the field is evolving. We are having more novel therapies available for recurrent endometrial cancer. In the past, we used to have only single-agent chemotherapy, and that was it, in which the benefit is very, very, very small. But now, in addition to pembro and lenvatinib, we have, for patients that are HER2 positive, we have trastuzumab deruxtecan. So what I would do is, in this patient, I would order HER2 testing based on IHC, and if it's 3+ or 2+, those patients that benefit tremendously from trastuzumab deruxtecan. So those would be the two options. That I would consider. I think hormonal therapy for some patients that have low-grade endometrial cancer that are ER/PR positive, that are more fragile, I think hormonal therapy, it's a good option as well. The benefit is not as robust as what we see with perhaps as pembrolizumab or trastuzumab deruxtecan, but it's just like very managed. The side effects are very, very manageable. And I would think that, I think in the next 6 to 12 months, we're going to have another antibody conjugates available for the second line in endometrial cancer.
And just curious, so, lenvatinib and pembro, like I said, we use in the pMMR patient, but have you ever used it in a dMMR patient?
So if you have a patient that is MMR deficient and has a recurrence, you can use pembrolizumab or dostarlimab alone. You don't have to use it with pembrolizumab and lenvatinib. Actually, the original data for immunotherapy was in these patients that I one of the slides I showed. So if I have a patient that is mismatched, repair deficient, and has a recurrence, I would probably just use immunotherapy alone and not with lenvatinib, and to avoid the side effects. And the benefit is, I think, very similar.
Makes sense. I want to ask Jacqueline about MRD. Can you explain a little bit of, I think in your case, you mentioned MRD. Can you explain to us a little bit what MRD is and how we might use it?
MMRD is essentially it's the lack of protein that's there. Mm-hmm. And so when we look at those cases and we look at the pathology, that really just kind of helps us determine, you know, what treatment is going to be effective for them. And so we really use that as kind of the guide treatment and guide, you know, therapy in regards to what's our next treatment option for those patients.
Okay, yeah. And some of us might use MRD. How many people have heard of MRD? So minimal residual disease. So it's a kind of a biomarker that we use in real time. So sometimes patients are coming asking if we can test their blood to see if their cancer is coming back. And MRD is a blood test. It's like a liquid biopsy. Some people talk about it that way, that can help us monitor a patient's response to therapy and potentially monitor them during remission. Are you using MRD at your institution?
Absolutely.
And do you use it in endometrial cancer patients?
Insurance dependent,
yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
I would love to say yes, we can use this for all patients at a Q3 month interval, but unfortunately, it does depend on insurance. Sometimes we're alternating ctDNA with scans, but again, it's going to depend on that patient population.
Okay, yeah, and I was curious at well, actually, we're out of time, sorry. All right, we're going to go into toxicities with lenvatinib and pembro, so this is going to be really important to review.
Yes, so the Len-Pem regimen does have a lot of toxicities. I'm excited to get into this with you. I'm going to skip over this just so we have a little bit more time to focus on our slides. So this is a patient. She's 70 years old, history of hypertension, hyperlipidemia, and aortic stenosis. She was a 3C proficient MMR status with a nice positive 3+ HER2, papillary serous uterine cancer. And so again, as it was mentioned, these pap serous cancers are a little bit more aggressive, and she was platinum refractory. So she had her XLAP with her abdominal hysterectomy, BSO, debulking, and lymph node dissection. Again, in her molecular profile, she was P53 overexpressed. She was the proficient status, which we've talked about now, and ER positive and HER2 positive. So she started on the regimen we were just discussing with the carboplatin and trastuzumab for 9 cycles. She was doing really well without really a lot of side effects during that first 9 cycles, but then she did have imaging that showed some distant recurrence, and she was started on Len-Pem. So the reason this is bolded, and I wanted to bring this up first, is because her lenvatinib dose was at 14, with our starting dose typically 20, and then, of course, her pembrolizumab at our standard dosing. So why? That should be the first question. You know, why did we not start this patient at a 20 milligram dose, and why did we start her at a 14? Why did we dose reduce in the very beginning? And we actually kind of do that a lot. And the reason for this is because this patient was previously getting screened every 3 months with echo because of her trastuzumab. And so while she was being screened with echo, her moderate aortic stenosis progressed to severe aortic stenosis. So in combination with cardiology, it was recommended that she start on a dose reduction of her lenvatinib because we again know that the cardiovascular risk for these TKIs can precipitate cardiac stress, heart failure, pulmonary edema, MI, arrhythmias, especially with pre-existing disease. Of course, it's important to note that this patient was nicely maintained on atenolol and lisinopril prior to starting therapy, which was nice for us, in addition to her statin and her aspirin. And we continue to manage her very closely with cardiology during her lenvatinib journey. It's also important to mention that these patients should not be on certain calcium channel blockers because of some interactions, which we'll get into in a second. So, our clinical trial data and our real-life data does show that many of these patients, the majority of these patients, are having AEs, especially with our lenvatinib cohort. Typically, about 2 months, these patients experience a dose reduction, and the majority of these can be hypertension. So hypertension management is something that we're talking about with our patients at every visit prior to even consent. We're talking about this. So it's important that these patients and their family members are aware of this, in addition to their PCP and their cardiovascular team, if they have one. We're monitoring their blood pressure. The patients all have blood pressure cuffs at home. First-line therapy is going to be the ACE inhibitors or the ARBs, and again, we're avoiding calcium channel blockers. GI toxicities are pretty common. About 50% of our patients are going to have GI toxicities, with diarrhea being the most common. When we're talking about management, it's important to understand grading. So these patients who have less than 4 stools over baseline, we do supportive care. We can do the loperamide with a starting dose of 4 and then 2 subsequent after. If they start having 4 to 6 stools per day, we're having a little bit more of a serious conversation about this being a more significant AE and possibly holding the lenvatinib if this is persistent. We can always start Lamotil. We usually try to get GI involved pretty early with these patients, because if they do progress to grade 3, we're in the hospital, we're getting GI-involved colonoscopy, usually some mucosal testing. And of course, it's important to note with these patients, having dietary conversations, super important. We want to have frequent small meals, try to avoid a lot of fluid intake so they can really focus on the calorie intake. These patients are going to be advised to stay away from greasy, spicy, high-fiber foods, stay away from caffeine and alcohol, maybe even dairy if they're sensitive, and to try to increase oral hydration. And so we do, if we're thinking that this patient is going to be high risk for some GI issue and possibly need nutrition support, we'll get that on pretty early. So we have a team of nutritionists that works very closely in our cancer center, so we can get them to at least have a pre-habilitation appointment with these patients to give them some education. Again, as I mentioned, increase your frequency of meals, try to get a lot of calorie-rich food. So big conversation that I'm having with patients on this regimen is, how are you, let's keep a calorie diary. What are you eating? What are you eating pre each meal? What are the foods that you're eating? Are you just eating, you know, cereal in the morning? That's not going to cut it. We're going to need you to be on something that's a little bit more calorie dense. So that's where education in the very beginning and throughout treatment is super important. Again, some of these patients might have some mucosal injury to the mouth. If that's the case and that's why they're not eating, we want to have dental involved pretty early. There are some gentle mouth rinses that they can use and some prescription mouthwashes. But if these patients are getting to the point where they're losing massive amounts of weight and you're thinking about having to discontinue, you can do some medical management. We usually don't, honestly. We can usually just do dietary management, but that's also an option. So how do we distinguish between the lenvatinib versus the pembro toxicities? And that's actually relatively easy to do, because our lenvatinib has a very short half-life. So if we hold, which is usually the hallmark first, hold this drug first, if the toxicity resolves, then we're pretty sure that's what it is. Versus the pembro, as I mentioned in the previous conversation, these toxicities can be latent and they can last for quite a long time and even start after the patient ends these medications. The hallmark of pembro management is going to be steroids, where the hallmark of lenvatinib management is going to be holding and symptomatic management. So again, clinical pearls here. So if you have a patient who's coming in and they have kind of watery but frequent diarrhea without blood or mucus, and you're asking them about this, a little bit more of the lenvatinib, but if you are dealing with a patient who has fever and they're having really bad abdominal pain and they're having blood or mucus in their stool, then we're thinking a little bit more of that pembro. Fever is not typically associated with the lenvatinib, although hallmark here, hypertension. So if a patient's coming in and their blood pressure is out of control, we're going to hold that lenvatinib, start them on antihypertensives, which is less likely due to the pembrolizumab. So these medications are typically started at a 20 milligram dose. Dose reductions occur in this cadence, 14 to 10 to 8. The capsules are conveniently made in 10 milligram and 4 milligram strengths, making dose reductions quite simple. And then, again, as I mentioned in our previous case, our patient did start at 14, and that was in combination with cardiology decision too. So most of these patients, 66.5% of these patients, did require a dose reduction, and our clinical trial research does not show a significant change in PFS between these patients receiving less than 20 milligram or the 20 milligram standard dose, which is another counseling aspect you can discuss with your patients, that don't worry. Even if we have to do a dose reduction, it's okay. It's not necessarily going to change the course of your treatment or how well you respond to this treatment, because we have a lot of anxiety related to this.
Okay. Thank you so much. We're going to move right into other nursing considerations and the care of patients with advanced endometrial cancer. Take it away, Jacqueline.
All right. So when we think about endometrial cancer, we're thinking about our patients. We have to assess, you know, symptom burden. You know, they have a life outside of our office and our treatments, and so it's crucial to assess that. And it can be for improving a patient quality of life. The symptom burden assessment can guide supportive care, optimize treatment, and can directly impact prognosis, functional status, and treatment adherence. So in regards to improving quality of life, the systematic assessment allows a clinician to identify and manage symptoms such as fatigue, pain, sexual changes, and psychological distress. In regards to guide treatment discussions, monitoring symptom burden allows for timely interventions, preventing premature treatment termination, and ensures better adherence to therapy. Identifying those recurrence and progression early, monitoring for those symptoms, educating patients about signs and symptoms of disease, and it allows us to tailor supportive care and making sure we refer them to palliative care or other supportive services when needed. So some key symptom areas to monitor, so physical pain, are they having pain? Is their pain managed? Do we need to increase their dose of their pain medication? Fatigue, are they sleeping like they should? Are they having GI symptoms that are not allowing them to, you know, do their normal activities, not able to go out and be with their friends and family? And so really important to kind of monitor all of those things to help patients as they continue on with their treatment therapy. Emotional distress, depression, anxiety, that can really, you know, affect their overall being. And so we need to make sure that we're not only addressing the cancer, but all the other emotional comorbidities that come along with having a cancer diagnosis. And then overall functional status, are they able to get up and move around and have that fulfilling life that they want to have and we want them to have? So optimal timing for early palliative care and advanced endometrial cancer is within that first 8 weeks of diagnosis. They have either a new diagnosis of endometrial cancer or they have a recurrence. And so there's a lot of emotions that go around that. You know, they either thought they were cured of their cancer or now they have this devastating metastatic disease. And so there is a lot of good outcomes that come from introducing this early palliative care to kind of treat those symptoms as fast as that we can. So they're particularly effective if we enter palliative care early with high symptom burden at start of treatment. So it significantly improves quality of life. Early palliative care can manage symptom burden, produce better coping skills, improve mood, and in some cases even enhance survival rates. So the impact on quality of life and clinical outcomes, rapid symptom relief, so they're really good about getting in there, and palliative care can manage all of those other side effects that they're having from treatment or their emotional distress, enhance psychological well-being, improve patient empowerment, and potentially keep them out of the hospital, so lower care intensities. Depression is pretty prevalent in our advanced endometrial cancer population, exceeding 40% to 50% in some studies, measuring emotional distress coupled with obesity and poor sleep. So if these patients who have this depression, they're more likely to be obese and have poor sleep habits. Advanced disease increases the risk of major depression episodes up to 3.5 times to the general population, and often peaking around diagnosis and treatment. 47% of endometrial cancer survivors experience depression and mood, as well, up to 64% reported anxiety. the mental health disorders increase with stage of cancer. So the higher stage of cancer you have, the higher risk that you're going to have a mental health disorder with depression or anxiety. Obesity, again, higher rates of depression and lower quality of life. And depression can be associated with a higher risk of mortality. Highest risk occur within about 2 months of diagnosis, indicating there really need to assess this early at diagnosis. And a lot of patients don't report it, and many of us don't assess it. So it's important to actually, you know, make sure how are they doing at home, how are they coping, are they having depression, are they having anxiety, and really intervene early can produce better outcomes for these patients. And so referral to palliative care, supportive care, social workers to help address those things can really be beneficial to the patients. As we've seen throughout this presentation, being involved in clinical research is very important. As we continue to advance and we continue to learn from these patients, they're able to be accessed to cutting-edge therapies that they may not be able to. And so it's really important to educate those patients that there are clinical trials out there, and then we think that these drugs are going to work in your particular situation, and you could see benefit that other patients who are not on clinical trials could have. Treatments may be more effective, they could or could not be less toxic, and when you're on a clinical trial, that you really see personalized care, lots of communication with the patients and the providers, the research team, to ensure that those patients are taken care of. Even the office visits are a little bit more frequent, and that's because we want to ensure that those patients are taken care of and all the toxicity is addressed. And so some patients are hesitant to go on a clinical trial because they don't want to feel like they're a guinea pig, but just educate them and saying that they're, you know, not a guinea pig, and that we are here to hopefully improve your outcomes. And being on a clinical trial can do that. So, and then, you know, it will help future generations and future patients that they may or may not see a benefit from this, but your future patients may seek that. So, and then a little case study here. So this 66-year-old patient. Last seen her GYN with the birth of her last child. How many times have we heard that? You know, divorce, lives alone. She reported some postmenopausal bleeding, went to her PCP, and then again referred to GYN. Her transvaginal ultrasound showed a stripe of 53 millimeters. Endometrial biopsy did show this endometrial cancer, high grade. She was referred to us. CT scan revealed a 2.2 centimeter right pelvic lymph node. She underwent hysterectomy and was diagnosed with this 3C UPSC, so unipapillary serous carcinoma, so one of our high-risk endometrial cancers that usually do a little bit more poorly with treatments. At her first post-op visit, she expressed some worsening depression symptoms. She had stopped taking her antidepressant several years ago. But was not having any suicidal or homicidal ideations, and we restarted her on her paroxetine. She started on chemotherapy, Taxol, Carbo. At her pre-chemo visit, after cycle two, she reported grade two fatigue, insomnia, loss of appetite, losing weight, and was just exhausted and didn't want to continue chemotherapy. And at this point, you know, her symptoms could be from chemotherapy, but also she has a history of depression. And so really assessing the depression part was key to this patient. She admitted that the paroxetine that we started her on really wasn't helpful to her. And so we then referred her to our supportive care team and had some counseling and medication adjustment. Ultimately, she was switched from paroxetine to mirtazapine, which can also help with some depression, also with some loss of appetite. Subsequent cycles, she was better tolerated, and her appetite improved and was sleeping better. She had more energy and was able to complete her six cycles of chemotherapy. So addressing not only the chemotherapy side effects, but also the mental health is really important, as we need to remember when we're seeing those patients and address those things as they come and make some medication adjustment as needed, and then refer as well to get those patients the help that they need.
All right. Thanks so much for sharing that patient with us. On behalf of Dr. Neil Love and the Research to Practice team, thank you so much for spending your morning with us. Thank you to our amazing presenters and for the awesome discussion. And I hope you have a great rest of your meeting. Thank you so much.